Lynn Valencia, and I currently serve as the Vice Chair of the Community Foundations Board of Governors. I'm also the Vice President of Community Relations at Nine News. On behalf of the board, we've got music.
We've got quiet enough to hear the music.
So on behalf of the board and Community Foundation staff, we welcome you to our 2017 annual investment meeting. We appreciate the opportunity to share the foundation's highlights of the past year, our investment fund results, and the financial outlook for 2017. So housekeeping. Restrooms are out and to the left, and there's plenty of food and coffee and juice. Please enjoy all of this stuff during the meeting. You can get up, no problem. But before we get started, I'd like to acknowledge we have a number of current board members and past board members here this morning. If you would all stand up, we'd like to just recognize you for being here. And Penn Feltate is also one of our board members. So here is a brief look at our agenda. So first I'm going to invite my colleague Dave Bomberger to share some information about the foundation's financial structure. Then we'll turn it over to Wendy Dominguez and Scott Middleton from Innovest Portfolio Solutions. And finally, Linda Ricketson, Director of Development here at Community First, will come up and say a few words. So Dave and I serve on the foundation's board of directors. This year, Dave has taken on the role of chairing the Finance and Investment Committee and has been on the board since early 2015. So Dave, welcome.
Valerie is going to be using me as her ventriloquist dummy back here, so if you see my lips moving and no words, I mentioned that to her a few minutes ago, and she said that her father used to do it, and the mannequins, not dummies, scared her to death. So anyway, thanks. Thank you all for being here this morning, and pleasure to share some great news with the results from last year. My name is Dave Bomberger. I'm currently the Vice President and Chief Investment Officer at Pinnacle Assurance here in Denver. We provide workers' comp insurance for Colorado employers, for their Colorado employees. That's kind of my day job, but I'm also proud to be a member of the Community First Foundation Board of Directors and Chair of the Finance and Investment Committee. That's one of the ways that I give back to the community, and Pinnacle, by the way, is very supportive of all of its employees giving back to the community, and we're very proud of that. The FIC, as we refer to it, the Finance and Investment Committee, provides oversight for staff for a number of the financial functions. The slide that you see in front of you is the structure. There's the board of directors, the FIC, the investment consultant. You'll meet Wendy and Scott from Innovest here in a few minutes. The custodian bank that holds all of our securities, as well as Fargo and our auditors. That slide is also in the materials that you have. It's the page right after the agenda, if you want to refer to that later. I think I only see one of my other fellow FIC members here, Hereford Percy. Hereford, if you'd thank you for being here. And we've got a great group of varied skill sets that I think help the committee and help the board execute its role. So how did things go in 2016? Overall, it was a pretty positive year for the markets, generally. It started out a little rough. Some of you may remember that the first 6 weeks or so of the year, the market was down as much as 5%, but it bounced back nicely. And the S&P 500, as one measure of stock performance last year, was up about 12% by the end of the year. Our portfolios reflected this kind of performance, as we're broadly invested in both stocks, bonds, U.S. stocks, non-U.S. stocks, and our long-term portfolio returned a little over 7.5%, and the short-term portfolio returned nearly 6%. we're very pleased with those results and the impact that that can have for all of you in this room. Most importantly, it's my pleasure to introduce our partners from Innovest Solutions. Innovest is a Denver-based registered investment advisor that provides investment consulting, wealth advisory services, and a whole lot more. To give you a sense of Innovest's accomplishments, let me give you a couple of items of recent recognition. In 2015, Innovest was named on the Forbes list of top wealth managers. Innovest ranks number 14 in the Financial Advisors 2016 Registered Investment Advisor ranking and number 15 for fastest growing firms. In 2016, Innovest ranked number 3 on the Forbes magazine and RIA channels fastest growing RIA firms over the last 10 years. And Innovest was named one of the best places to work in money management magazine in 2016 by Pensions and Investment magazine. It's my pleasure to introduce Wendy Dominguez and Scott Middleton.
I have a lapel mic. I'll try not to hit it. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming. Let's see the clicker. My name's Wendy Dominguez, and Scott Middleton and I are here today representing our firm, Innovest, and we're very proud to be here. We're passionate about investment, so hopefully that comes through in our presentation. But we're also passionate about what you here at Community First do, and we have been proud partners of Colorado Gives Day for each of the last 6 years. And our firm this year participated as a corporate sponsor. We challenged our team for 100% participation, and we got it. We have 40 employees, and we had 100% participation. And for that participation, if they reached the 100% goal, they got their birthdays off as a perk, as well as one of the charities that they donated to, we drew out of a hat and gave a $1,500 company gift to one of their charities. So we fully embrace what you do here, and we're really proud of our partnership. I'm going to talk about the first two items on the agenda here, and then, as I said, my partner Scott is going to talk about 3, 4, and 5. So process drives fiduciary responsibility. So we believe it's our responsibility, and our the common thread among all of our clients is to help them follow a prudent investment process. And here we start with analyze, figuring out what their goals and objectives are, move to strategize, how are we going to help them meet those goals and objectives, formalize that through an investment policy statement that can be our tool and our roadmap to get there. We'll implement it with investment managers and strategies. At Innovest, we don't select individual stocks and bonds. We help select the investment managers that then have a portfolio of underlying stocks and bonds. And then we monitor those results, and then we start all over again. So it's a continual circle. It's something from an asset it's one of the most important things we do as a firm. Asset allocation drives 90% of a portfolio's return. So it's the most important thing we do as a firm. And we spend a lot of time on it. We spend hundreds of hours towards the beginning of every year really looking at has anything changed? It's not something that we just set and forget. It's something that we go back to on a continual basis to say, are the markets changed? Is there something else that we need to tweak with the asset allocation because of that? Have the goals of the client changed? Is something different in that relationship? And again, it's something that we continually revisit. And this shows that is, especially with Community First, that there have been changes over time. We've hedged the portfolio for rising interest rates, which we're finally starting to see. We've introduced other asset classes that aren't as interest rate sensitive to the portfolio, and we reviewed on an annual basis. We didn't make any real changes in 2016, and we're getting ready to make the same presentation to the Finance and Investment Committee in just a few weeks about our 2017 projections. The reason why asset allocation is so important is demonstrated on this busy slide on page 8. But it's one of my favorite slides. What it does is it ranks the best performing asset class to the worst performing asset class from every single calendar year going back from 2007 to 2016. And then it has the same color for every asset class. So what it's meant to demonstrate, and hopefully you can see this, is it's very random. From one year to the next, it's very random as to what's the best performing asset class versus what's the worst. But if you look at the black boxes, which represent a diversified portfolio, you can see they hug right around the middle. And then over the long periods, which are the two lines and two groups of boxes on the right-hand side of this chart, diversified portfolios are towards the top from a return standpoint and towards the bottom on a risk standpoint. And ultimately, diversification is the best tool we have in order to control portfolio volatility. And that's what this kind of busy chart shows. So as far as the asset allocation for the short-term portfolio, our goal here is about 2% over inflation. And our expectation for inflation over the next 5 to 10 years is about 2.25%. So our goal for this portfolio is 4.25%. Now, we think it's important to not only focus on the goals, but what's the risk? How much could this portfolio lose in a really poor one-year period? And that's what the minus 7.9% means. So if you are invested in this portfolio, our goal is that you'll earn about 4.25% per year. But in a really bad year, this portfolio could lose almost 8. And so we think that's an important trade-off for the Finance Committee to understand and you to understand as well as you're thinking about, is this the right portfolio for my funds? The long-term portfolio, the goal here is more aggressive, 5% over inflation, so our goal here is about 7.25%, and then more risk, as you would probably imagine. In order to earn the 7.25% return, we need to be able to accept them. No one wants negative returns, but we need to be able to tolerate a minus 18% return in a single year period in order for that return trade-off of 7.25%. Dave talked about performance, and we are really pleased with the performance for both portfolios. In 2016, the portfolio was up 5.95%. Our long-term goal is at CPI plus 2, so the actual CPI, or Consumer Price Index, plus 2% for 2016 was 2.12%. So that translates to the 4.12% that you see there. And then we go back 3, 5, and 7 years. Since inception is since Innovest inception in 2010. So this short-term portfolio has annualized about a 5% return per year since January 1st of 2010. The custom index is also listed there in purple, and that represents a blended benchmark of the underlying asset allocation. So this tells us how well the investment managers did relative to their benchmark. So if we were just holding the passive strategies, the passive indexes in the allocation that the short-term portfolio has, this is what the custom index would have returned. So in 2016, the last 5 years, the last 7 years, and since inception, the short-term portfolio has not only beat the goals of CPI plus 2, but also beat the custom index as well. Similar story, not quite as great about performance relative to the custom benchmark as we saw in the short-term portfolio, but generally the long-term portfolio has also done a good job of meeting its goals of CPI plus 5, as well as performing close to the custom index. And I think it's important to note too, and I didn't point this out before, but the custom index has no fees, where the Community First Foundation portfolios, those returns are net of fees. So I think it's important for you to understand that as well as you look at past performance. But in 2016, the long-term portfolio was up 7.63%. The CPI plus 5% number was 7.18, and the custom index was 7.76. And you can see that goes back a little longer since we've got the performance prior to Innovest being involved here as well. So we think it's important not only to look at performance relative to benchmarks, but also performance relative to peers and performance relative to risk. And this is a great chart on page 13 because it kind of looks at all of those things together. The crosshairs on this graph represent the average or the median peer group, which is small endowments and foundations with assets under management less than $100 million. We actually purchased this universe. It's not just Innovest clients. It's a universe that we purchase. And so the crosshairs represent that median fund. Returns are along the vertical axis, and risk, as represented by standard deviation, is along the horizontal. And so you can see that the square, which represents the long-term portfolio, is in that northwest quadrant. And that's the best quadrant on this graph, because it means you are getting higher returns than your peers and taking less risk. Actually, that's the long-term benchmark, the square. The triangle is a long-term fund. So we're slightly behind the custom benchmark, but we're still in that northwest quadrant for the actual long-term fund performance. So on page 14, we break out the equities and the fixed income performance so you can get a little bit more dissection into the portfolio. In 2016, the equities within the short-term portfolio were up 8.69%. The benchmark was up 10, so you can see that the equities struggled, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a couple of minutes. Fixed income, or the bonds, were up 4.86% in 2016, relative to the benchmark, up 4. So bonds, relative to benchmarks, did very well in the year. And then the total fund, as we talked about earlier, is up 6 relative to 5.5. On the long-term fund, 8.29% for the equities here relative to the benchmark at 9.5. The fixed income, exceptional here as well, 6.35 versus 5.44. And then the total fund, 7.63 relative to 7.76. We do have January numbers, which were very strong as well. January, the short-term fund was up 95 basis points, or 0.95%, when the benchmark was up 0.84. And in the long-term fund, it was up 2.03%, where the benchmark was up 1.57. So hopefully, who knows what will happen for the remainder of the year. But it was a nice start with January. So we've included some key themes about performance. So I mentioned that the equities underperformed their benchmarks for the year, and the fixed income managers performed pretty well. So on the equity side, what were the main drivers of performance? And it really comes down to underperformance, and it really comes down to the fourth quarter and the reaction of the markets after the election results. In that time period, there was a dramatic shift into the stocks and the sectors that did really well prior to the election versus those that did well after. And it was healthcare, that, as you could probably imagine, based on the campaign promises that President Trump had, healthcare struggled, and financial stocks, based on the fact that the anticipation of reduced regulations on financial firms really took off. Financial stocks in the fourth quarter were up 21%, and stocks like Bank of America, Goldman Sachs were up over 40. So there was a huge outperformance in the fourth quarter, a huge sector rotation. So some of your active managers that had done really well prior to the fourth quarter didn't anticipate, as most didn't, the election results, and as a result, some of the equities underperformed. On the international side, the decision of the managers to be over-allocated to the UK relative to Japan hurt. Japan was one of the best places to be for the full year, and so that decision hurt some of the international managers. On the fixed income side, I mentioned that the fixed income managers did tremendous relative to the benchmark, and a lot of that was based on the fact that we did have different types of fixed income investments in the portfolio. We have opportunistic fixed income, which isn't benchmark sensitive. It can really go anywhere it likes in the bond market, and a lot of the opportunistic managers in the portfolio went to the high yield area, which was one of the strongest places to be for the year. And then also the introduction of floating rate corporate loans, which is another asset class that has an interest rate that floats with LIBOR or Fed funds, so it doesn't have as much interest rate sensitivity as other sectors. So those decisions really benefited the portfolio. Dave talked a little bit about what went on in the year. It was a strong year for large caps. It was even a stronger year for small cap stocks. Small cap stocks were up over 20% in the year. So those, actually the mid cap and the small cap managers within the portfolio on an absolute basis did really well, and the mid cap managers did tremendous in the portfolio. It was also a rotation where value managers outperformed growth. And so the value managers in the portfolio did really well. Emerging markets was another strong year. After a dismal 2015, emerging markets performed very strong. And the international managers that had an allocation to emerging markets did very well. And we talked already a lot about the fixed income portion of the portfolio, but risk was very much rewarded in the year. High yield, floating rate, things that had a little bit more credit risk relative to interest rate risk did very well. So as far as key takeaways for you to bring back to your boards and the people that you report to, asset allocation was great, and I think that was what we were trying to communicate with the chart with the crosshairs, that you, both the benchmark and the portfolio were in the upper northwest quadrant, which means you're doing better than your peers from a return standpoint as well as a risk standpoint. So asset allocation did really well. The fact that we weren't on top of or higher, the actual fund wasn't higher than the benchmark, is because the managers didn't do quite as well as the index, but that is why asset allocation and diversification is imperative. There's always going to be portions of your portfolio that underperform, and there's always going to be, as we saw in that quilt, things that are really good from one year to the next, and it's really important that you spread out that risk and you reduce risk that way. But I think the general message is total performance has been solid, and asset allocation has been a great additive. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Scott to give us a little bit more about the current economic environment.
The next section that we're going to talk about is what's going on with the economy, what's going on with the markets, how does it impact your portfolios? So in this process, let me kind of give you a high level of how we approach this topic. I mean, there's so much news coming at us every day about the economy and markets. Politically, that's a whole other topic. So one of the key things we do, first of all, is say, well, what's most important? Then we sort out opinions from facts. Now, there's some smart people that we like to listen to their opinions, but what we tend to focus more on is what's the data, what are the facts telling us? And then with that information, we develop what we think is a long-term outlook of what's reasonable to expect for the markets going forward, what's reasonable to expect from the economy going forward. So what I'm going to do is look at not only, you'll hear crazy opinions, you'll hear crazy forecasts about basically to try to motivate you to buy their newsletter or subscribe to their service or put your money with them. So there's always some possibility of extreme things. What we also tend to do is look at what's more probable than not going forward with the markets. And again, looking forward long term. So what I'll do here is let's look at some of the major topics that we think are most important when you look at the economy. First of all, what's the pace of growth? The chart here on the right shows real GDP annualized percentage change. And you'll see both the emerging markets of the world, so that's South Korea, China, India, Brazil, Russia, South Africa, Taiwan, Thailand. And it also shows the developed markets. In that is the US, the UK, Germany, France, Switzerland, Japan, so the major economically developed countries of the world. And here you see the year-over-year percentage change in the growth of their economy. Well, you see, the emerging markets are growing more quickly, but they're also starting to slow down in the pace of growth. Whereas the developed markets, the long-term average is closer to, say, 3.5% or 4% for growth. And here you see that we haven't had 3.5% since 2010. So we're in a very slow growth economic environment for the developed markets and a slowing growth for the emerging markets as well. Now, some of the major issues long-term is that there's very little, if any, in some cases, growth of the working age population in the developed countries of the world. So for example, in Japan, the size of their workforce is declining and is expected to over the next 40 years. Most of continental Europe the same. The US, we're basically doing a little bit better than those. And then also the issues of the middle class in the emerging markets is a significant growth expected in the coming years. So that is a long-term factor that should sustain their growth, perhaps more than the developed markets. So globally, we're in a slow economic environment. So let's look at the US as well. Let's focus a little bit more here. The chart on the right side of here, page 22, shows the last 11 recessions and subsequent recoveries, percentage and GDP growth. And what you see is that the very sluggish low line at the bottom, that's been the current expansion since, well, the recession in 2008 and the recovery since. So why has the, people still think that the economy is not very good among certain circles. And by historical standards, yeah, it has really struggled over the last 9 years, last 10 years. So then why? Well, you might remember that in 2008, we had a severe recession based on the credit crisis. So the banking system basically froze up. The government had to step in with extraordinary measures. The housing market, which was part of that crisis, also was a key factor where the housing market froze up. And then we had an increase in taxes and regulation during this time period that we believe has slowed the pace of growth. So what does this mean for going forward? Well, you'll notice that that blue line, even though it's at the bottom, is one of the longest periods, the number of quarters, or the time periods on the horizontal scale. So you'll notice it's one of the longest periods of a recession and a recovery. So does that mean we're overdue for a recession? Well, there's a phrase that economic recoveries don't die of old age. They're all murdered by the Federal Reserve. So what that means is, what's the Federal Reserve doing? Are they trying to make it easy to borrow? Or are they trying to make it more expensive to borrow? That's one of the key levers we'll talk about. Currently, the Federal Reserve is being pretty accommodative. Short-term interest rates are low. So it is altogether pretty still accommodative when it comes to getting a mortgage or a car loan, etc. So the Federal Reserve is still being accommodative. So we will have a recession at some point. It looks unlikely for the next year, at least for the US, because again, the Federal Reserve is not concerned about inflation. We'll talk about that here shortly as well. So we're in a slow economic environment, very sluggish. It's likely to continue for a while. And let's look at some other different topics. Inflation. So what you see on the chart on the right is the expectation that inflation will rise. And you'll notice, especially since 2012, this is a survey of global fund managers, that there has been a greater anticipation that inflation will be increasing in the future. And in fact, that number or that reading has spiked since the election in this last November. So near term, inflation is pretty low. You take out food and energy, assuming we don't eat or have to drive anywhere, that inflation is about 2.2% higher now than it was a year ago. Now, the Federal Reserve watches inflation because that's their number one long-term enemy. If the Federal Reserve is concerned about the economy overheating and prices going up, they are likely to make it more expensive to borrow to try to cool down the economy. Now, the Federal Reserve and some comments that Janet Yellen made yesterday again indicate that we take the data as it comes. We're watching inflation, we're watching unemployment. Inflation is not getting out of hand currently, so that's why they've been slow to raise rates. So, they're always data dependent, it's called. The Federal Reserve is frankly really lousy at predicting when it's going to raise rates and how much. Their governors sit together and they make forecasts at every meeting and they revise them. Basically, you look at their forecasts and they have nothing to do with what they ended up doing a year or so later. And also the financial markets are not really good at all about predicting what the Federal Reserve is going to do as well. But near-term inflation is an issue. If there's a significant infrastructure spending or commodity prices rise, whether the metals or commodity prices in agriculture, et cetera, that'll have a bump up in inflation. So we think it's reasonable to expect that normally when you have low unemployment, inflation is likely to rise. So that's kind of the inflation outlook. Looking at monetary policy, we were talking about the Federal Reserve a lot here. This is page 24. What you see on the right is for the US, the UK, Japan, and the Eurozone. What the market expects, like, are these central banks going to be raising rates over the next couple of years? Are they going to be lowering them or keeping them about the same? The current expectation in the US is that the Federal Reserve will be raising rates gradually over the next 2 years, but not dramatically. You see in the far right for March of 19, the forecast was about 1.75%. The long-term average is closer to 3 or 4%. So by historical standards, the Fed has been extremely generous to try to keep the economy moving, in part because the growth has been so sluggish like we saw. When you look at Japan and the Eurozone, the central banks there are very focused about trying to keep their economies moving ahead. We are seeing some more positive results in the Eurozone in particular, that there is some building momentum for their economic growth after some very, very difficult circumstances. So the Federal Reserve raised short-term rates once in 2015, and at that point in time they said, well, we're probably going to raise rates four times in 2016. And what did they end up doing? They raised them once. So again, you have to look at what not the Federal Reserve is predicting, but actually their actions speak more louder than words. One of the concerns long-term for the economy around the world and for the U.S. is the level of debt. The G7 economies, the major growth economies of the developed economies in the world, shows the amount of public debt and the amount of private debt. And the U.S. is not singled out here, but let me kind of notice the pattern here, is that the private debt over the last few years has kind of leveled off. You notice that? A lot of consumers in the U.S. have paid down their debt, refinanced it, and some have actually had to foreclose or file bankruptcy and default on their debt. But the big increase has been the public debt, the level of government debt around the world. So you see the consumer being a little more reasonable in their debt levels, where the issue is more on the government side, both U.S. and also around the world. Now, we're lucky right now that the U.S. government doesn't have to pay a lot of interest on its debt. I mean, you can get a 10-year treasury now for about 2.5%. That's way below the long-term averages. But if inflation rises, so will interest rates, because bondholders will be compensated for higher inflation. So if in the future interest rates rise on government debt, it's going to put the U.S. and the developed countries of the world in a really difficult position, where more and more of their budget is going to be going to pay off the debt at a higher interest rate. So, and of course the wild card here is China's level of debt, both their public and their private debt. That's a wild card yet to be clear exactly how that might turn out. So let's go with debt, employment, and wages. On the right side of the chart is kind of a different one. We like a lot because it shows the wage growth year over year. And what it does is it takes out the effect of baby boomers retiring at higher wages and younger people coming into the workforce at lower wages. And so what this reading does is says, well, for people who are staying in the workforce, staying in their current jobs, what are their wages versus a year ago? And this is a different reading than what you may hear in the press, that, you know, for most, if you look at the whole workforce, wage growth is about 2.5%. The latest reading for this was actually in the high threes. Here it's a little over four, about 4.25. So as unemployment has come down, people who are still in the workforce have been able to get some decent pay increases because companies are more willing to hang on to the people they have. It's a lot cheaper to hang on to somebody than to replace them and train them in the workforce. So if you look at wage growth is picking up, the headline number is not inspiring, 2.5%. But normally, when you have unemployment go down to 4.8%, it gets harder for companies to get new people in their jobs, and they have to raise their pay or raise the pay or people keep the people that they currently have. So long-term, you know, one of the biggest issues, as I mentioned, is that the workforce is not growing in the developed world, in Japan, continental Europe, And it's going to be more of a challenge in the employment picture going forward for economies to keep growing when the workforce is aging so significantly. So, fiscal policy and politics. We can't avoid it. Here we have on the right side of the chart is global trade as a percentage of GDP. This is on page 27. So you'll notice that it's kind of topping out and rolling over. And we're seeing not only in the US, but continental Europe and elsewhere, that there is significant concern about how global trade impacts me in my situation, how it impacts my economy, my workforce. And so I think we probably have seen generally the biggest increase by far in global trade, and this is in the crosshairs. If you listen to most economists, they will say generally tariffs on trade and raising barriers to trade is generally long-term not helpful for either our economy or the world economy. So this is a concern for the global economic picture going forward. And on the political side, one thing you did not hear in the last election is any issues of the fact that half of the U.S. government's budget is to three programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Half the budget is for those three areas. And they are growing significantly as the baby boomers retire in the coming years. But there's no discussion that's getting any kind of press at all about the fact that when that half of the budget is going to be growing and crowding out other areas, that you have to look at some very difficult decisions about how to have the reform to some degree in those three programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And that lack of political courage, because it's political suicide to talk about reforming those areas. I mean, anybody who wants to win the state of Florida in particular will never talk about reform of these areas. And neither of the two candidates last November talked about it, and Congress now is not even talking about it. So that is a long-term significant issue for the U.S. as far as our level of debt and what it means for the long-term health of our economy and our country. So those are some of the key building blocks that we look for going forward on the economy. Sluggish growth, which seems more likely to continue, a recession not near-term in the U.S., but eventually we have one, because that's part of the economic system. And what's key, I would say the two things to take away here are, one, watch what the consumer does with their money. For example, retail sales in the U.S. are 4% higher now than a year ago. That's taking out gasoline because that fluctuates in price a lot. That's a pretty good level. You take out, so it's 4%, you take out 2.25% for inflation. Is it robust? No, but it's really pretty healthy. So the consumer's feeling pretty good about spending. That's one of the key areas to look at. The other key area is, what's the Federal Reserve doing? Is it trying to make it easy to borrow, cheaper to borrow, or is it trying to stifle the economy and bring down inflation? So far, the Federal Reserve has not decided that they need to murder the U.S. economy, murder U.S. inflation in particular. So, then we turn, what does this mean for stocks, bonds, other investments? So, I'm on page 28, and you see on the right side are three ways to look: are stocks expensive, the higher the lines go? Are they undervalued, are they cheap? And how does that compare to the 25-year average? So the first of these three is the U.S., large cap stocks in the U.S. And see that the blue bar in the middle, that's the average valuation over the last 25 years by one measure. And the diamond measure is, where are we now? And then, of course, the bar is the range of things over the last 25 years, from cheap to expensive. So by historical standards, yeah, stocks in the U.S. are getting a little expensive. Dramatically so? No, not necessarily, but above average. The DM, the second, developed markets, so again, Japan, continental Europe, and the UK, right about average as far as the 20 compared to the last 25 years. So not abundantly cheap or expensive there either. And the last on the right is emerging markets by a different measure. And you see that the emerging markets are priced on their stocks below the long-term 25-year average. And one of the key reasons we look at this is that the current valuations is really important when you look forward in the markets on stocks. In fact, it's probably one of the major factors, not the only one. And this is really demonstrated on the next slide. So the main message is here. You see the scatter on the left? That's your starting valuations and your subsequent one-year returns in the stock market. So over to the left side of your world, when stocks are less expensive, trading, say, 11 to 14 times earnings. Over to the right side, they're more expensive. And you see that you can start out with a cheap stock market and it can get cheaper in the next year, prices can go down. Or you can start out with an expensive stock market and sometimes prices go higher over the next year. But there's really no distinct pattern. This really is kind of a scattershot. And by the way, this is one of the reasons why a one-year forecast on the markets is really was worthless. That's why we, none of us, look ahead 5 years to 10 years, because what can happen in a one-year period is pretty random. Well, what you see on the right side of the page, same data, stocks and their subsequent returns over the next 5 years. And it's not the most perfect pattern in the world, but you see that when you start with stocks that are cheaper, your subsequent returns tend to be higher versus when they're expensive. So currently it marks where we are in the environment, close to 17 times earnings, kind of in the middle over the next 5 years. There have even been periods at this similar place in the past where returns have actually been negative, more positive than not, however. But looking at this causes us to be more temperate in our view. You might remember March 9th. Well, for those of us in the investment business, we remember dates and amounts. And March 9th, 2009, so almost 8 years ago, the Dow Industrials was at 6,600. Stocks were cheap. They were at this left end of the spectrum in this range. And where we are now, we're at 20,000 on the Dow. That's even without dividends. Dividends are on top of that. So we've seen a tremendous run over the last 8 years for stocks that come from very cheap to probably a little bit above average with valuations. And that is part of our thinking why it's probably more reasonable to expect in the next 5 to 10 years for large cap stocks, probably something closer to about 6.75% average annual returns, not the double digits that we've seen over the last 8 years in particular. So for valuations and where we are in the economy and the economic cycle, we want to be a little bit more sober about future expectations. So those are equities, U.S. around the world. Let's look at bonds. So these are high quality bonds. These are the yields you get from what's called the Bloomberg Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, which is really a mouthful. So what are those? Those are treasuries issued by the U.S. government, high quality corporate bonds issued by companies like Procter & Gamble, ExxonMobil, etc. And also high quality mortgages. So these are investment grade bonds. What are the yields you get? Well, back in the early 80s, you could get double digit yields easily by investing in bonds. So that's the lighter line, is what's the yield. Now the darker line here is, well, what did you get over the next 5 years if that was your starting point? So back when yields were higher, your returns the next 5 years were higher. And where are we now? Well, at the end of 2016, the yield of the Barclays Bond Index was at 2.61%, a long way from even the 6.5% average or so over the last 20 years. So we know, this is not real rocket science. I mean, a lot of investment management has all these terms and there's a lot of information, but this is an area that's really pretty simple. If you start with high yields on high quality bonds, your next 5 years are going to be pretty good. If you start with low yields, you will be much more sober about your forward returns. So one of the questions that we look at is, well, why have yields come down so much? The fear of inflation has come down so much is really one of the simple answers to that. Now, if the fear of inflation picks up, we will see higher yields on bonds. If yields go back up, we'll probably talk to the committee about raising the allocation, the percentage of the portfolios in fixed income. But because yields are so low, now we have to be a little more creative in our asset allocation. There are a couple of other areas here, floating rate corporate loans. They're close to their long-term averages. This is a complicated chart. If you'd love to really understand all the details here, please come to me later. I'll be glad to discuss that with you. But floating rate corporate loans, their payouts, as Wendy mentioned, increase as the Federal Reserve raises interest rates. And they're attractive, but they also come with some risk. You can't eliminate risk, you have to spread it around, is the key way to manage risk. High yield bonds as well are probably below average of their attractiveness. So we're getting a little bit more modest in our expectation there. These are below investment grade. When they do well, they're called high yield. When they do really poorly, they're called junk bonds. So they've done great the last 8 years. We think they're not quite as attractive. So one of the issues that the finance investment could look at is, we want these portfolios, especially the long-term portfolio, to grow over time. Well, back back in 1997, you could have a 100% high-quality bond portfolio, and what was your yield back then? It was 7%. It was a simple thing to design a portfolio, non-diversified, but it was a simple exercise to say that, you know, you could have a simple portfolio, and your standard deviation, kind of the bottom line in the lower left of page 33, standard deviation is about 6. So it means you get 7% plus or minus 6 about two-thirds of the time. Well, in 2017, we just saw yields on bonds have come down so low, even the last 20 years. And to have a portfolio that would generate, theoretically, a return of 7% on average going forward the next 5 to 10 years, you'd have to diversify a lot more broadly. You'd have to have a lot more in equities and other investments. And notably, in the very bottom, your standard deviation is almost 3 times higher to get to that same expected return than you would have designed, say, 20 years ago. So that's part of the challenge as consultants and for the FYC is how can we have these CPI plus targets and reach them over the long term and still be able to diversify the portfolio and mitigate the risk the best that we can. It's a great challenge to have and one that the committee has fully embraced. So I would say in sum, you know, we want to be more temperate in our outlook for the returns going forward. Does that mean that you should embrace a lot more risk? Well, oftentimes the answer is that you really should lower your expectations for the future returns, especially in riskier assets and bonds. And volatility right now is extremely low, one of the lowest points in the last 20 years for the U.S. stock market. We know it's going to raise its head at some point, and one of the key things that the committee does is it has an investment policy statement that navigates them through periods of high volatility. So, for example, one of the key things that is important is rebalancing the portfolio. Let me give you a simple example. It doesn't really apply to your portfolios. But let's say in 2008, at the end of the year, say you had a portfolio that was half in stocks and half in bonds. And if you did nothing in your portfolio, by the bottom of March 9th, 2009, your portfolio would have been about, at the most, say about 35 to 40% in stocks, and the other portion in bonds. So at the bottom of the market, if you did not rebalance your portfolio back to that 50-50, you would have your lowest equity exposure at the bottom of the market. And alternatively, if you had not rebalanced over the last 8 years, you would have your highest exposure at much higher equity levels and also valuations. So we think it's a great discipline for the committee. It's in their investment policy statement that we're constantly checking, is the portfolio's allocation within balance? Are we fairly close to our targets? And rebalance back to those when markets change or when money comes in or out of the portfolios as well. So that's a key discipline that the most effective money managers and investment committees make over the long term is to handle volatility, to have a method to get through it, including rebalancing. But we know that, you know, even though we're looking forward, even though, you know, we think we make some reasonable projections for returns and what the economic environment looks like, we know that there are going to be surprises. That's just part of the exercise of looking forward. And that it's essential not to manage the portfolio based on this expert's opinion or that expert's opinion or extreme possibilities, but to stay diversified and to look at what's more probable than not going forward. So that's what typically is a great demonstration of the most successful investors, the committees, and the organizations over time, is to embrace these principles. We have some questions at the end, but let me just conclude with a few more things. So I've kind of already hit this. What's the committee going to review? We're going to take another 5 to 10 year outlook at our upcoming meeting. We're going to say what's reasonable to expect. Can we help temper the risk reward and diversification of the portfolios in a way that would be, we think, a prudent approach going forward? And at the current time, we're always looking for opportunities. We're just, again, more modest in our expectations. We need to look at inflation because, you know, what matters for your situation is that, you know, the cost of helping the people and the organizations that you help, their costs don't go down or stay level. They increase over time. So one of the key things we work with the committee on is how can we design these portfolios over the long term to keep up with inflation? And if inflation should rise, if it does, what parts of the portfolio will help going forward? But as consultants, we know that, you know, you have to look at the pros and cons of every decision. We don't have any proprietary products to sell and invest. We don't have our own mutual funds. We don't try to be the best money manager in every asset class. We think it's best to, you know, look forward to find the best, highest quality money managers, and active and passive. Institutional pricing, where you get not what a retail investor would get off the street, but to get the share classes and the agreements for separate accounts where you can negotiate the fees to a very reasonable level. And, you know, we're not trying to make grand forecasts and make splashes in the news. We're trying to use a prudent process, and that's what the committee is obliged to do. And as consultants and co-fiduciaries, that's what we're obliged to do as well. So those are some highlights. And at this point, we're going to have some Q&A. And we'll try to remember to repeat the questions so everybody can hear. And for those who are also listening to this on the recording, and we'll hopefully repeat those for them as well.
Right. Okay, so we're going to take some questions now. So there are some microphones. Kayla has a microphone, so if you have a question, she'll provide you a microphone so that we can get the right person to answer. So, okay. Any questions to start off?
Nothing? I'm not smart enough to have a question.
Point it this way, not up at the speakers.
Where's
the speakers are in the ceiling.
My name is Bart Crawford. Oops, sorry. Is that loud? McIntosh Academy is a small private school in Littleton, Colorado, that has just joined Community First as an endowment partner in the fall. And we started with a modest, account balance to take advantage of some of the incentives that were offered in this past year, and I know that they're, you know, sort of continuing in 2017. But my question is mostly tactical, because we're inexperienced with, you know, this process in general, and as it pertains to Community First Foundation. We're not at a point yet where we're taking earnings out of the endowment funds. We want to build critical mass to begin to then fund programs like scholarships for our school and so forth. But when we do, and we set that that earnings distribution percentage at any given year, let's say we set it at, you know, 4% or 5% to come out to, you know, to fund certain activities at the school. In the case that the portfolio has a down year, are you able to take out a distribution in excess of the performance that year? So if, let's say we were set at 4 or 5%, the return on the portfolio was zero or negative. Are you only able to take out that 4 to 5% distribution if you've got sort of an accrued interest on your principal balance, or are you able to, you know, dip into principal to, you know, to meet that constant earning stream that you planned on as an endowment partner? How does that work?
Wendy, you want to take that?
Well, no, thank you for your question. That's a great question. The way that our funding agreements work is based on a percentage that we work with you to establish based on your needs and how you think, and even which portfolio you want to be in. If you set a spending policy that is really intended for perpetuity, you'll be in our long-term portfolio. If you have a very aggressive spending policy, you'll be in our short-term. And so most of the folks, and if you qualify for an endowment match, it means that you were in that long-term portfolio with a spending policy that's intended to be in perpetuity. Under the Uniform Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act, you are allowed to, quote, dip into principal. It really defines endowment in a way that it is the spending policy that's the governance, as opposed to never touching principal. But the way our fund agreements work is that when your percentage will be based on your then balance of the endowment, and if that has gone down because of market losses, that will affect your distribution. Same story on the other side. Even if we had 20% growth, wouldn't that be wonderful? Your distribution policy would still be whatever is set in that fund agreement. That we have had instances, they're very rare, but we've had instances where there are extraordinary circumstances where we work with organizations to try to make sure that their endowment is still a valuable tool for them. But we still work with the, those are exceptional circumstances. They're not just, oh, we're in a down market, let's give people 10% distribution instead of 4% or 5% distribution. So it does level out over time, but like rebalancing is part of the discipline. So is taking that percentage in the good times and the bad times and trying to level it out over time. Does that answer your question?
Well, just to follow on, in the fund agreement, my understanding is we've set it at zero for our account currently as we build the critical mass that I mentioned. Are you able to adjust that percentage? You know, when you start taking distributions, are you able to adjust that percentage every so often? Or is that, are you saying that, you know, in a rebalancing kind of format annually or whatever the appropriate period is? Or
keep in mind that the percentage distribution is a maximum distribution. You can always take less. And as you saw on some of the return expectations here with slowed economic growth, we're not going to expect to get the double-digit returns that we've had in some years. So that even at 5% spending, you could be, you know, sort of eating your seed corn, if you will, if with the purchasing power, with this, the consumer price index plus your 5% distributions. If we're not making, if we're in markets where you cannot, with a reasonable amount of risk, make that 7.5% return, your 5% distribution could be too high if you're really looking at, in the, you know, taking a long-term perspective. So it's a maximum. You can always take less from your endowment. You can always do what you're doing now, which is let's get to a critical mass before we take distributions. But once that policy is set, to that maximum amount. And I would say if you qualify for a match, we would expect that when you do negotiate from zero to something, that something would be 5% or less.
Hi, Dr. Jackie Phillips, and I'm the board for Colorado Outreach Project, which is for low-income families, preschool, kids with disabilities. So I'd like to thank you for asking the question, because I was like, yeah, that's what we need to ask about, too. So this is an impressive presentation. I understood about maybe an eighth of it at the most. We're endowment partners. We just have a very, you know, it's a baby endowment. The reason why we're here is, you know, we're looking for ways to maximize. Now, I don't know anything about the investing thing. I'm also on the board for Adams County Economic Development, so I see a lot of the same, you know, charts and graphs. I'm glad that they match up. I'm confident with that. But so my question is just, you know, and maybe this is not a group question. Maybe, you know, we need to just sit down and have an individual meeting. But basically, we're just trying to see how to maximize, you know, funds. And so, like, when I hear, oh, Colorado Gives Day, and, you know, all the employees contributed, you know, of course, you know, I'm like, okay, did we get a piece of that? Did we get a piece of that? So my question is just how, for this, you know, very small endowment, preschool kids with disabilities, it's a cause everyone can jump onto, right? And so my question is, what are some of the ways that we can maximize, or what are some of the incentives, or what are some of the opportunities that we have for our nonprofit through Community First?
Actually, Linda's going to be talking when we finish our Q&A about some of the opportunities, both the endowment incentive program, which we've had many years, but it unfolds in different ways from year to year. And then also Colorado Gives and the participation there. And then our endowment partners, we do have a series of educational seminars, etc., that help you with fundraising, planned giving, try to really build your capacity to be the best fundraiser you can be, because that's what it comes down to. At the end of the day, you have a compelling mission. How do you couple that with some really great strategies?
Okay, any more questions? Okay, we are always available. If you have additional questions that you might think of later, just reach out to Marla or Ken or any of the staff here at Community First. So now I want to introduce Linda, and she's going to just say a few words and then close out the program.
Thank you. Not so many questions, that's great. You did a fabulous job. So thank you all of you for being here today. I'm just gonna do three quick updates from highlights from 2016. First is that Community First is really committed to helping strengthen nonprofits. And one of the ways that we do that is through our nonprofit endowment partner, helping you all to grow your endowments to build for the future. In 2016, we provided 29 incentive grants, totaling about $200,000. Through the generosity of our board, this year that amount is $305,000. We've made a couple of tweaks to that program. I'm around if you have any questions about that. In the binders that were provided to the nonprofit endowment partners behind tab 2, there's a flyer about the incentive program. I'm sure you've gotten an email about it. You'll probably get another one. And again, I'm here if you have any questions about that. The second thing I want to talk about is an incredibly successful Colorado Gives Day. A big shout out to Dana in the back, our Colorado Gives Day here. So Colorado Gives Day remains the largest giving day in Colorado, and it's the second largest giving day in the nation. This year, on December 6th, I'm not advancing my slides.
I need an assist from Valerie.
So this year, donors gave $33.8 million to 2,140 nonprofits on December 6th. It's just incredible. It continues to grow. It was 28.5 million dollars last year. In total, since 2010, Colorado Gives Day has raised more than $145 million for Colorado nonprofits. Yeah. We're incredibly grateful to all of our participants. Our corporate partner, First Bank, our other sponsors, Nine News, thank you, Lynn, for your media sponsorship, and Invest for all that you do through Colorado Gives Day. And also to all of you, or the 2,000 plus nonprofits who participate on the day and help spread the word about the day. Finally, another strategic priority for the foundation is powering community by promoting mental wellness. Last year, our community impact team launched the Innovator Society. The Innovator Society was designed to improve mental wellness by investing in fresh new ideas that improve awareness, foster well-being, and change perceptions about mental health. The Innovator Society is a 9-month coaching program to improve mental wellness by it culminated in, there were 6 participating nonprofits, and it culminated in a community pitch showdown in September. There were 250 community leaders in the audience, and the 6 innovators presented their ideas and mobilized $500,000 in investment in grants. So we have a short video about the Innovator Society we'd like to share with you.
When I was volunteering and realized how good it was for me and what a tremendous impact it had on my mental wellness, I had that light bulb moment of realizing that this was a way that we could help other people improve their mental wellness in a very innovative fashion.
We know more than 1 million of us experience a mental health or substance use disorder each year in this state, but we also know that most folks aren't getting the care they need. So we need new ideas.
Mental health is an area where the need for innovation is constant and acute and really pressing at this point in time.
We formed the Innovator Society to support promising but not yet proven approaches to mental wellness. By creating an accelerator program, we could advance solutions more rapidly than just by providing a grant by itself. We provided each innovator with a team of coaches in areas of strategy, marketing, and executive skills.
For coaches to be coming from such a wide variety of backgrounds took the whole thing to a complete new level.
The innovators also honed their presentations throughout the accelerator program through a series of pitch scrimmages, where they received real-time feedback from business and community leaders.
All of this work of our innovators led up to a final community pitch showdown, where we empowered the community with financial resources to vote on the innovations.
Applying to participate in something like this can help your organization think about what do we want to be doing, what gaps do we need to be filling.
As part of the process of going through the Innovator Society, we really became more clear on how to tell our story to impact volunteers, potential funders, and other members of the community.
I want people to know that the Innovative Society is just that. It's very innovative, and it's going to challenge you in new ways. It's going to push you to new limits, and it's going to say, you know what, there is great potential in our communities, and are you willing to take that journey?
This is such a new model. It's so incredible to see so many people who attended the Community Pitch Showdown and supported the nonprofit innovators really coming around this idea of new solutions to mental wellness in our community.
When we put the power of philanthropy in the hands of our community to take big risks on innovations around mental wellness, great things are going to happen. We want you to be part of the Innovator Society. Join us, empowering community together.
Great, thank you. So now it's time for a drawing. We find this meeting to be incredibly important for you to participate in, and so as such, we have two $500 incentive grants available for the drawing, and so I will... McIntosh Academy, congratulations. And Junior Achievement. So this concludes our program.